This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. In Kyiv, Ukraine, on Monday, the President's Day holiday in the U.S., President Joe Biden announced additional military support for the embattled nation on a surprise visit. VOA's Myroslava Gengadze reports from Warsaw.
President Biden announced additional delivery of military supply for Ukraine, as well as additional sanctions against elite and companies who are participating in Russia's war machine. He emphasized that over the last year, the United States has built a coalition of nations from the Atlantic to the Pacific to help defend Ukraine with unprecedented military, economic, and humanitarian supply. Miroslava Gongadze, VOA News, Warsaw.
Volodymyr Zelensky said on Monday, a world order based on rules and humanity depends on how events play out in Ukraine. He said, quote, it's right here and now in Ukraine that the future of world order rules humanity predictable is being decided, Zelensky said in his nightly video address delivered after a surprise visit to Kyiv by U.S. President Joe Biden. Zelensky said defense and other needs for putting an end to Russian aggression this year were already well known, including by Ukraine's partners. A new 6.5 magnitude earthquake has killed three people and injured more than 200 in parts of Turkey, laid waste 2 weeks ago by a massive quake that killed tens of thousands. Officials say more buildings collapsed, trapping some people, while scores of injuries were recorded in neighboring Syria, too. It comes again just weeks after the February 6th quakes. This is VOA News. Israel's parliament on Monday voted to push ahead with a contested overhaul of the country's judicial system, championed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's religious nationalist government that has sparked mass protests. Opposition in parliament vowed to, quote, fight for the soul of the nation, while tens of thousands of Israelis gathered in the streets outside trumpeting their objection. Lawmakers argued late into the night before the proposed changes were approved in a first reading. After heavy rain, mudslides barreled through homes in North Sao Paulo State, while some annual carnival festivals have had to be canceled in Brazil. AP correspondent Charles de la Desma reports.
In Sao Paulo State, Sebastião and Bertioga, two of the hardest hit places, have cancelled their carnival festivities on the event's main day as rescue teams struggle to find missing, injured and the feared dead in the rubble. Sao Sebastião mayor Felipe Augusto says teams are not managing to get to several locations. It's a chaotic situation. Augusto posted on social media several videos of widespread destruction, including one of a baby being rescued by locals lined up on a flooded street. I'm Charles de la Desma.
Former Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan was granted protective bail by a court in the eastern city of Lahore on Monday, providing him respite from arrest for 2 weeks in a case that involves charges under the country's anti-terrorism laws. Khan has had several cases registered against him since a parliamentary vote ousted him from power last year. The cases range from gathering illegal funds for his political party to inciting violence against state officials. Students returned to Michigan State University in the northern U.S. a week after a deadly shooting on campus. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Many professors allowed students to be in class virtually. Being back, student Gabrielle Bain described it to WXYZ-TV as weird.
It's amazing to see how much support and love we're getting, but it's like almost inescapable, you know? Everywhere we turn, every street you go to, it's a reminder of this horrible tragedy that is still extremely recent.
Many students at Michigan State skipped class to attend an afternoon protest at the state capitol. They call for gun control legislation. Governor Gretchen Whitmer says she wants universal background checks, safe storage laws, and extreme risk protection orders. I'm Ed Donahue.
Prosecutors have downgraded the involuntary manslaughter charges against U.S. actor Alec Baldwin, reducing possible prison time the Hollywood star may face in the 2021 fatal shooting. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today is Tuesday, February 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. President arrives in Poland after a surprise visit to Ukraine as the war grinds on.
Freedom is priceless. It's worth fighting for as long as it takes. And that's how long we're going to be with you, Mr. President, for as long as it takes.
Tensions rise on the Korean Peninsula as Pyongyang conducts second weapons test in 3 days.
Virtually every North Korean launch of any system that goes a long way is done at a lofted angle so that it really doesn't pass or be that provocative towards its neighbors.
And hundreds of rescuers in Brazil search for survivors after flooding kills dozens. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Poland by train on Monday following a surprise trip to Ukraine. Air raid sirens blared as Biden landed in Kyiv for a meeting with President Volodymyr Zelensky ahead of the Russia's invasion's one-year anniversary. It comes on the heels of concerns that Ukraine is burning through munitions faster than the West can supply it. Matthew Laratonda of Reuters reports.
Air raid sirens blaring in Ukraine's capital on Monday, at the same time that U.S. President Joe Biden landed there for a surprise visit in just days before the one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion. Biden was in St. Michael's Cathedral with President Volodymyr Zelensky as it happened. There were no reports of Russian missile or airstrikes in Kyiv, but it underlines the grinding nature of the war, which has seen no major changes on the ground for months. Biden is using the trip to announce $500 million in new military aid to Ukraine, including air defense radars, weapons for taking out armored vehicles, and artillery ammunition. Allies have recently voiced concern that Ukraine may be burning through ammo faster than the West can supply it.
Today we also discussed the issue of long-range weapons and the weapons that can be supplied to Ukraine, which were not there before, and this is very important.
Freedom is priceless. It's worth fighting for as long as it takes, and that's how long we're going to be with you, Mr. President, for as long as it takes.
Biden made no mention of donating Western fighter jets at their joint press conference, which Ukraine has been pushing for, and if granted, would be another upgrade in firepower after the recent pledges of modern Western tanks. Zelensky did say, though, that he and Biden discussed long-range weapons. This could be warplanes or better missile systems. So far, the West has resisted both of these on fears that they would be used to strike deep into Russia and even further escalate the war, although some members of Congress have told Reuters that they believe consensus is building on Capitol Hill to provide Ukraine with American-built F-16 fighter jets. Meanwhile, as Biden visits Ukraine, China's foreign minister is heading to Russia. China has so far remained neutral in the war, despite its close relationship to Moscow. The West fears it could begin supplying Russia with its own weapons.
That's Matthew Laratonda of Reuters. North Korea fired 2 short-range ballistic missiles in its second weapons test in 3 days. Monday's firing drew quick condemnation from its rivals and prompted Tokyo to request an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. North Korea also fired an intercontinental ballistic missile Saturday and has threatened an unprecedented response to U.S. South Korea military drills. The powerful sister of leader Kim Jong-un warned that Pyongyang's use of the Pacific as, quote, its firing range, unquote, will depend on the behavior of U.S. forces. For more on the escalating tension, I spoke with VOA's Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo.
Virtually every North Korean launch of any system that goes a long way is done at a lofted angle so that it really doesn't pass or be that provocative towards its neighbors. It goes high, high above the earth and comes pretty much straight back down into the ocean. There is a threat that Kim Yo-jong, there's a possibility that she's threatening that North Korea may extend the range of those things, possibly even testing missiles towards further out in the Pacific Ocean, possibly towards Guam or Hawaii or something like that. That would be a major provocation. You know, as far as reactions, U.S. and South Korea, Japan, it's all pretty much established how they react to such things by now. They are conducting more and more military drills is the main response these days.
To the extent that the North Koreans continue to test and fire these missiles, experts say they're learning along the way, both in trajectory, both in distance, and both in power, in case if they decide to really, really launch something that might cause some harm in that peninsula.
Yes, no, it's true. They do learn things each time they test these missiles. It's not just for fun that they're sort of launching missiles. One of the main things we're looking for now is that North Korea could soon test its first solid fuel intercontinental ballistic missile. And it sort of sounds like, you know, overly techie in some ways. But the bottom line is, if North Korea has a solid fuel ICBM rather than a liquid fueled ICBM, it is much harder, theoretically, for the United States or anyone else to destroy that missile in the preparation phase as it's being launched. Solid fuel missiles are already fueled. They don't need to be fueled. And it takes hours and hours to fuel a liquid-fueled missile. So this would be a big leap in technology. And, you know, it might sound sort of like I'm lost in the details here, but it really does matter if North Korea gets that capability. That's something they could be getting soon. If they tested missiles at longer ranges, you know, not at a lofted trajectory, that could also give them important sort of know-how and expertise in how to actually make these intercontinental ballistic missiles, which sort of, you know, leave the environment to actually re-enter the atmosphere and actually hit a target on the ground. So, you know, there's many things that they could do within these missile launches to sort of extend their expertise and sort of make the threat bigger to the United States. And honestly, a lot of people expect that in the upcoming year.
That's VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo speaking with me from the South Korean capital. For the past year, Poland has led a refugee response as millions of Ukrainians fled the Russian invasion. Meanwhile, Poles are having to adjust to the large-scale warfare taking place on their doorstep. As Henry Ridgewell reports on the border, that conflict spilled over into Poland late last year.
Pszewodów is still in mourning for its two lost sons. The small village on the Poland-Ukraine border was thrust into the centre of global attention when, on November 15th, a missile exploded on this farm, killing two local workers. All that remains is a large crater. NATO and Western allies said the explosion was likely caused by a stray Ukrainian air defence missile. But at first, many feared it was a Russian attack. For a few terrifying hours after the missile exploded, the world believed that Russia's war on Ukraine had come to Europe, to NATO territory. And as the conflict escalates, the communities here continue to live in the shadow of war. The leader of the local council, Grzegorz Drewnik, says there have been many fearful moments over the past 12 months. The worst were the first days of the war, when the front was moving here to the west, and nobody really knew at what point it would stop. Nobody knew whether we would be bordering the Russian Federation in any moment. Over this last year, a lot has changed. Lots of grief, sadness, anger. Well, later on, I guess it's human nature that you get used to everything, Drewnik said. The communities along the border were the first to witness the fallout of Russia's invasion a year ago. Friends Natalia Kostikiewicz-Kolasinska and Renata Zhua live in Tomaszów Lubelski, a few kilometres from the border. Very quickly, people started coming in, Renata said, and here our whole community mobilised, and people rushed to help the Ukrainians who were streaming into our town in big numbers. Our family, who live further away from the border, called us very scared, Natalia said. They asked us if we had passports, if we were going to escape in some way. It didn't occur to us at all because we were so involved. Like thousands of other Poles, Natalia took in a Ukrainian family, 7 people in total. She says she has bad days where she fears the war is coming closer. Some of the conversations we have are about what our plan B is, she said. We have in the back of our minds all the time that something is going on. When I wake up in the night, you can hear the warplanes. You can hear them really circling overhead. It's hard not to think about the war. Thousands of refugees still travel across the border from Ukraine. In the opposite direction, Poland is the key conduit for Western weapons being sent to aid Ukrainian forces. For the people here, war doesn't seem far away. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Przewodow on the Poland-Ukraine border.
Thank you, Henry. Another earthquake struck the border region of Turkey and Syria on Monday, just 2 weeks after the area was devastated by a large quake which killed more than 47,000 people and damaged or destroyed hundreds of thousands of homes. Monday's quake, this time with a magnitude of 6.3, was centered near the Turkish town of Ataka and was felt in Syria, Egypt and Lebanon. This, as the bodies of Syrians killed in last week's earthquake are being returned home for burial, overwhelming local cemeteries. Millions of Syrians fled to Turkey to seek refuge from the civil war. Dorian Jones reports from Syria.
At the Syrian rebel-controlled Bab al-Hawa border crossing with Turkey, the bodies of those killed in the deadly earthquakes return home. For their loved ones, it's a painful wait. Khalid Halal Assad Rostam's brother, Mohammed, died while visiting his daughter, who was being treated in a Turkish hospital.
Hours before the earthquake happened, Mohammed told us that his child was in good health, but she had to finish her treatment. He said on Thursday he would come for a visit to his family in Syria and then return to Turkey to be alongside his daughter. Only hours after the call, we heard that the devastating earthquake killed him.
Millions of Syrians have found refuge from the civil war just across the border in Turkey. Many in cities hit hard by the quakes. Officials in Syria's rebel-controlled Idlib province are themselves dealing with the quake's impact, while also helping to facilitate the return of bodies from Turkey. Khalid Hilal now takes his brother, Mohammed, on his final journey back to the Syrian city of Binish. The cemetery is overwhelmed, but the local community is coming together to help. While the dead are buried in a mass grave, efforts are made to give as many as possible a temporary gravestone for loved ones and family to remember those they've lost. Dorian Jones to VOA News, Istanbul.
In other news, hundreds of rescuers in Brazil are searching for survivors of landslides and flooding that killed at least 36 people along the coast of the country's southern state of Sao Paulo following a huge weekend downpour. Worst hit was the city of São Sebastião, where at least 35 were dead. In neighboring Ubatuba, a 7-year-old girl was killed. The disaster in an area famous for beaches flanked by mountains prompted cancellations in many cities of carnival festivities. São Paulo State Governor Tarcísio de Freitas told television network Globo that another 40 people were missing. His state government said in a statement that nearly 800 people were homeless. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. A court in Nigeria has dismissed a lawsuit that sought to allow Nigerians to vote outside the country in the February 25th election for president. The ruling means millions of Nigerians living abroad will have to return if they want to exercise their democratic right. Nigerians abroad contribute billions of dollars per year to the economy through remittances, and supporters say the constitution should be amended so they can vote. Nneka Chile reports from Accra, Ghana.
The court dismissed the lawsuit citing the constitution, which states that only registered voters residing in Nigeria have the right to vote. The lawsuit by two Nigerians living in Britain sought to halt the February 25 election until millions of diaspora voters were included. The government in 2017 estimated 17 million Nigerians live abroad, though not all of them are 18, the legal age to vote. The court's ruling February 15 agreed that Nigerian diaspora should be able to vote, but that it was for the lawmakers to decide, not the courts. Nigerians living abroad had hoped to cast their ballots for president at Nigerian embassies and consulates. Nigerian Patson Mbimoji is a music programmer living in Britain who spoke to VOA via Zoom.
I feel sad. I would have really loved to cast my vote and, you know, vote for my own preferred candidate because it's a very crucial election, and Nigeria is at the tipping point where we need to actually get the leadership right going forward.
There are 18 candidates running for president in Nigeria's election Saturday. The front runners are former Vice President Atiku Abubakar, former Lagos State Governor Bola Ahmed Tinubu, and former Anambra State Governor Peter Obi. Nigerians living outside the country can still vote, but only if they have a Nigerian address and fly home to cast their ballot, which most cannot afford. The Abuja-based Nigerians in Diaspora Commission says Nigerians abroad sent more than $20 billion back home in 2021, the highest in sub-Saharan Africa. Despite their contribution to Nigeria's growth, diaspora have struggled to get support for voting from abroad. Nigerian lawmakers a year ago voted against a bill to allow diaspora voting. Nigerian human rights lawyer and founder of social justice group Citizen Gavu, Nelson Olanipekun, spoke to VOA via a messaging application.
Those in diaspora cannot be easily influenced by Nigerian politicians. And that seems like a possible excuse or rationale why the politicians refuse to amend the law to allow that provision.
Olanipekun says Nigerians abroad should be able to vote for their leaders because their government affects them wherever they are. Festus Okoye is the chairman of Nigeria's Information and Voters Education Committee of the Independent National Electoral Commission. He spoke to VOA via messaging application.
The position of the commission has been very clear and consistent. The commission supports diaspora voting, but we made it very clear that diaspora voting cannot take place within the existing electoral legal framework.
One of the plaintiffs of the failed lawsuit for diaspora voting, Kenneth Nkemenacho, posted on Facebook that they would appeal the case. Neka Chili for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
The Atlanta-based nonprofit Carter Center announced 98-year-old former U.S. President Jimmy Carter is receiving hospice care at his home in Plains, Georgia. VOA's Ken Farabaugh has more.
Yeah. Buffalo, New York native Suzanne Taylor says former President Jimmy Carter's declining health wasn't a surprise to her, but the announcement he was entering hospice care came as a shock.
I have to admit that I cried at breakfast. That was a little bit of a wake-up call to me that we really are going to lose him at some point.
Between 2006 and 2019, Taylor was among hundreds of volunteers working alongside Carter and his wife, Rosalind, on their annual Habitat for Humanity work project, building homes around the world for those in need.
So many people really appreciate him. He's had such an impact, and it's going to be so hard to close that chapter.
Jonathan Alter spent 5 years writing a biography about Jimmy Carter titled His Very Best that allowed him to interview and observe the former president before his health declined.
But when you take stock of his life, he won at life. 98 years, longest lived president, married for close to 77 years.
After losing the presidency in a resounding defeat in 1980, Alter believes Carter's increased popularity came through his volunteerism with Habitat for Humanity, his efforts to promote peace and fight neglected tropical diseases through the programs of the Carter Center, and as the voice of a seasoned politician and elder statesman. Carter's popularity also increased while traveling the country, autographing and promoting dozens of books he wrote, and by hosting crowds at his small church in Plains, Georgia, during his Sunday school lessons, where, one day after the announcement of his decision to enter hospice care, Carter's niece, Kim Fuller, led the congregation in prayer.
I think at this time in all of our lives, and in the lives of those that we love very much who are going through this today and we'll be going through it, that maybe if we think about it, maybe it's time to pass the baton. Who'll pick it up? I have no clue. Because this baton's going to be a really big one.
Which is why Taylor believes the news of his deteriorating health is that much harder for many to accept.
So I think his accessibility has created a bond with a lot of Americans that most presidents don't have.
Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say that up to 68% of everything in the universe is made up of something known as dark energy. Unlike normal matter that we can see and touch, dark energy and a third component called dark matter have not been directly observed, so they remain hypothetical. A group of researchers led by scientists at the University of Hawaii at Manoa have released two studies they say provides proof of cosmological coupling. which is something that allows the mass of black holes to grow without the need to consume gas or stars. According to a university press release, the study gives the first observational evidence of a link between black holes with dark energy, along with insight into what might exist inside black holes. The study researchers had to comb through data that spans some 9 billion years to reach their findings. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday, join us as we put the latest developments into a global context with stories, interviews, and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Fo in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns the unilateral decision by Sudanese authorities to release the specially designated global terrorist Abdel Raouf Abu Zayed. Abu Zayed was convicted, along with others, of murdering U.S. diplomat John Granville and Sudanese citizen Abdel Rahman Abbas, both employees of USAID, in Khartoum in 2008. John Granville was 33 years old when he was gunned down in the terrorist attack. He had been working on democracy and governance programs for USAID in support of a landmark peace agreement that ended Sudan's long civil war. Abdel Rahman Abbas, 39, was one of the original members of USAID's Disaster Assistance Response Team for Darfur. Abu Zayed was convicted and sentenced to death for his involvement in the killings. On January 30th, 2023, the Sudanese Supreme Court released him. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said, "The Sudanese claim that the Granville family had extended forgiveness is false. We call on the Sudanese government to exercise all available legal means to reverse this decision and to rearrest Abu Zayed." In a written statement, USAID Administrator Samantha Power said, "The lack of transparency about the legal process that led to the release of John and Abdel Rahman's killer is unacceptable, and the assertion that the 2020 U.S.-Sudan bilateral settlement of legal claims constituted forgiveness for Abu Zayed is false and misleading. We will continue to push for full accountability, and I and the entire USAID family extend our deepest condolences to John and Abdel Rahman's families as they continue to endure the trauma of the killing of their loved ones," said Ambassador Power. "As we work to honor the memory of John and Abdel Rahman and pursue justice for their murders, we remain committed to the Sudanese people and their aspirations for a peaceful, democratic nation." State Department spokesperson Price noted that the United States continues to engage with Sudanese officials at the highest levels and to demand action on this critical issue. "The safety of U.S. citizens and embassy personnel abroad remains the highest priority of this administration," declared spokesperson Price. "We will not relent."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.